1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Dennis Boardman, good afternoon.
That's me, yeah.
Yeah. What rank were you on this day 75 years ago, Dennis?
I was a corporal.
Okay, so Corporal Dennis Boardman, bring me back 75 years. Corporal Boardman, where were you at midnight last night?
Midnight, it had just been cancelled. It had been cancelled. We should have gone on the 5th of June.
Yeah.
But the weather was too bad. So we went.
So what time yesterday, Dennis, Corporal Boardman, did you get word that the D-Day was on?
We got word about 6 hours before we were due to leave.
Okay.
We were in transit camp waiting for the previous week.
And where did you depart from?
Depart from Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire.
So you were in a plane, obviously.
Yeah, but the plane wasn't a normal plane that you would see today. You would see a Dakota. We were in a plane which was called an Albemarle. And normally, the Albemarle was only used for towing gliders.
Oh, of course,
but
yeah.
We ended up in an Albemarle, and you couldn't stand up in an Albemarle. You had to sit down and crouch. And we had to do that for the hour and a half journey before we jumped.
Okay, I know you're now living in Cork, but take us back again. At midnight last night, 75 years ago, what happened, Dennis?
Well, we took off from Bryce Norton, and we circled round for an hour and met other aircraft, and then we jumped about 2 minutes before midnight.
Okay.
And when I jumped, There was actually a German searchlight actually on the plane I jumped from, and I passed through the beam of the searchlight.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got within about 20 feet of the ground, I had a kit bag strapped to my right leg.
Okay.
With a radio set in it, which I had to communicate with people as soon as I landed. It was a radio set plus my kit, but I couldn't get rid of the radio set, which would normally be on the end of a rope in a kit bag.
Okay.
But I couldn't release it, and I had to land with the kit bag and the radio set still strapped to my last leg. And I badly sprained my ankle, but I couldn't do anything about it, so I went on and carried on with a damaged ankle for the next week.
Wow. So you're now 14 hours in France, 75 years ago, Dennis.
Yeah.
Did you come under attack at all this morning?
Oh, yeah, we came under attack within about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about a thousand Germans attacked us, and there was a pile of gliders lying in the big fields close to where we were in the village of Roundville.
Mm-hmm.
And there was over 1,000 Germans attacked us, and we waited. We hid in Roundville, a group of us. And then we waited till the Germans were virtually only about 10 or 15 yards from us, old pile of them, and then we were let rip with our machine guns. And the Germans retreated very quickly. So it made it easier for us after that.
And Dennis, it's now 10 to 2. Where were you at 10 to 2 75 years ago today?
Oh, 10 to 2, I was still in Roundville at Roundville Crossroads.
Okay.
And met up with some of my other buddies and brought in, we went out to Le Mesnil, and we captured 6 Germans there, and I took the Germans back to where we were holding them. There was a tennis courts and we held them in a tennis court, the prisoners that we have, with six of them.
So you now have six German prisoners. The troops, the landing troops arrived on the various beaches at around...
About 6 o'clock,
yeah,
6:30.
About 8 hours ago. Now, have they got near where you are? You're near Pegasus Bridge now, you're near Ronville.
That's correct.
Have you any word on the land troops, 160,000 of them? Were they coming close to you?
We got word on the radio that they should be linking up with us within 12 hours.
And when do you expect them to arrive?
Well, we expected them to arrive round about lunchtime, 1 o'clock of that day.
OK, and have they arrived? It's now 10 to 2. Any sign of them?
Oh, yeah, they arrived about... just after 2 o'clock.
OK, so that's 10, 15 minutes.
That's correct.
Stay there, Corporal Boardman. When did you arrive? When did you land in Cork, Dennis?
When did I come to live in Cork?
Yeah.
Oh, I've been in Cork now about 30-odd years.
I was wondering where you got the Cork accent from. Say it's North Cork, obviously. Stay there, Dennis.
Yeah, OK.
Corporal
yeah.
Boardman, at ease for a sec. And Dennis, thank you for your service, by the way.
That's no problem. Thank you indeed.
Eileen Slevin, good afternoon.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Joe.
Who are you, Eileen? Who are you ringing on behalf
My dad, Bernard Gregory.
OK, yes. Bernard, what was his rank in the army?
He was a sapper. He was a corporal. Sapper Gregory.
What happened last night? How did you land in France?
Well, my dad never really spoke about it when we were growing up, Joe. And it was only in latter years when, I'm sure you're aware, he was interviewed by Gay Byrne on the radio for the 50th anniversary. And it was only then he started to talk about it. So the details are sketchy, but I can concur with what Dennis said earlier. He did say that on the 5th of June it was cancelled because of bad weather. But from what we know now, he landed in Versamur quite early in the morning. So that's Versamur on the Gold Beach. And they just had to scramble to get off the beach. And he told Gay, I remember listening to it, he said he hid between two bodies. But what he didn't say was that one of them was actually just a torso. What he saw as an 18-year-old Joe, he was 18 on the 6th of June. His 19th birthday, he celebrated in Versamur. And he met a family there. And one of the children was called Nicole, and he had a lifelong friendship with Nicole, and he met her again for the 60th anniversary. He went over and met Nicole and her family and her husband for the 60th anniversary. He was very young, and it was very traumatic for them, Joe. He was conscripted at 17. I mean, that was very young.
Because he was living in Manchester, but originally from Ireland.
His mother was from Ireland, Wexford.
Yeah.
But he was conscripted. He was living in Manchester, and he was conscripted at 17. But my granny had five boys, went off to war, Joe, and they all came home.
Incredible.
And his brother, Tommy, was on Sword Beach the same morning. So it was an incredible thing. But in latter years, before he died, the year before he died, he asked my son if he would give his medals into the museum at Versamur.
Okay.
So my family and I, my children, my husband, went over in 2008, and we actually presented the medals. They were thrilled. And we met up with Nicole. I met Nicole, and she brought us down to the beach, where it's the exact spot where my dad landed.
Incredible.
And I have to say, Joe, even thinking about it now, it's very emotional for her and for us to see where he landed. And all those young men, a lot of them lost their lives, you know, and but she made us feel so welcome. But the gas thing about it is, Joe, when she brought us to her home on one of the visits, we've been three times, on one of the visits she left the room at one point and came back and produced this A4 size photograph of my dad in uniform. And apparently he got a photograph taken for his 19th birthday. Her father owned a chemist shop and would develop photographs.
Incredible.
So he had written on it, to Nicole from Bernard. Now, she wouldn't give us the photograph, so we had to actually take photographs with our phone. But it's an amazing story, Joe, to think that he kept this friendship up, and Nicole, and they were so grateful. The people in Versimer were so grateful for what the men, all the young men, and the men, and Dennis himself, what they did that day to liberate France.
And as you probably saw this morning, Eileen, Versimer is featured on all the television
coverage. Absolutely. And Joe, I have to say, when I see these veterans on television, it reduces me to tears. And to think of all those young men that died, I thank God my dad didn't, he came home. But those young men that gave their lives, they were only kids, Joe. They were only kids. And I'm so proud of all those men on the television this morning and what they did for freedom, Joe. For world freedom, you know, because imagine if we were under Nazi rule now, what would it be like?
Okay,
but I just...
Eileen, here is Sapper Bernard Gregory.
This is the BBC Home Service. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. The first official news came just after 9:30, when Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, usually called SHAPE from its initials, issued communique number one. This said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces supported by strong air forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
Petrified. I'm sweating like a bull. I'm shaking like the leaf on a tree because we were clearing obstacles and clearing mines and then recovering any equipment we could that was lying around. And as we approached the coast, the Royal Navy started to let rip to soften up the defences. Actually, where we landed, the battle around Versailles that way towards Bayeux and Caen, they pulled back and embedded themselves at Caen. So in about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, it's comparatively slow, but there's still fire left, right and centre. You don't know where it was coming from.
Sapper Bernard Gregory, that's your father. When did your father pass away, Eileen?
He died in November 2005. Joe, he smoked wood pipes from the time he was 10 years old. Okay. He died of lung cancer, but he'd a good life. He was a great dad, yeah.
And what age was he when he passed?
Oh, he died a few months after his 80th birthday. Okay. He was 80 that year.
And did he keep? I know you say he didn't talk about it much.
But no, growing up we never knew anything, Joe.
But he was on with Gay, wasn't he?
Pardon?
He was on with Gay Bourne at one stage. I heard that.
That was for the 50th, Joe.
Yeah,
that
okay.
Was for the 50th. So it was only then it started to talk about it.
And then did he open up and did he keep...
Oh, well, then we would have been asking him questions.
Yeah,
we
of course.
We would have been
saying,
Dad, what did you do? And, we didn't know that. And he had medals, Joe, that we didn't even see growing up. You know, and it was just... I don't know whether he was traumatised by it or just...
Well, he said he was... Didn't. He said he was petrified.
He was. Joe, he was 18. He must have been absolutely terrified. And when I woke up this morning, I'm thinking it's a lovely day and God has blessed me with a lovely home and a family. He woke up and lots of men like Dennis, they were in the middle of all this turmoil and war and fear. And I take my hat off to Dennis and all those men who served for, as I said before, world peace.
Dennis Boardman, were you petrified?
Oh, you get a bit nervous, like, you know.
Okay.
You get a bit nervous, but you pass it by. You pass it by. And, you know, once you're in the plane and once you get the green light come on in the plane, the red light comes on, then the green light, and then you jump. You forget all about fear and anything. You're on your way, and that's it. And fear doesn't come into it because you've passed that point. Oh, yeah, great.
Okay, stay there, Dennis. Pádraig Yates. Pádraig, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
What was your father's name?
Patrick Yates.
And what rank was he in the British Army in 1944?
In 44, I'd say he was probably a corporal.
Okay, so Corporal Yates, what were you doing on D-Day?
Well, he was in somewhere south of Rome in Italy. He'd been in North Africa, Italy, ended up being medevaced out of Belgium in 45, but on D-Day he would have been, as I say, the other end of the continent. He'd have been somewhere south of Rome.
And what, because there was a piece, apparently by a Tory, was it the wife of a Tory peer?
Yeah, well, no, she was actually the first woman to be elected to Parliament and take her seat.
Okay.
Countess Markovic was there before her, but of course she never took her seat.
Yeah.
So Lady Astor inherited a seat. She was a wealthy American heiress, and she inherited the seat when her husband became a member of the House of Lords.
Okay.
She basically got the seat. So she was a very famous, very outspoken, very right-wing conservative. One Labour MP described her as the member for Berlin. She was a Nazi sympathiser before the war.
And what did she say about your father?
What she said about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, I suppose. They were D-Day dodgers, that they were down in Italy enjoying themselves while these poor young lads were having to fight in France. Of course, most of the men... Well, a lot of the men in Italy would have been there since 1940, 41, or like my dad from 42. So it didn't go down too well. And a song was composed about them called We Are the D-Day Dodgers. So a lot of resentment. Now, it was not to take away in any way from the suffering and the sacrifice made by the men who landed in Normandy at all. But it was aimed at her and people like her.
And isn't the famous quote, Lady Astor, to Winston Churchill in the House of Commons, when if you were my husband, Mr. Churchill, I'd put poison in your coffee, and Churchill replied, Nancy.
He'd drink it, yeah.
If you were my wife, I'd drink it.
That's right, yeah.
And did your father, Corporal Patrick Gates, Parry Gates, did he talk about the Second World War?
Not really. You know, like a lot of people, he didn't say. He'd talk about it, there'd be no problem. But if you talked to him about the war, if you didn't know the historical context, you'd think he spent 5 years of his life fighting the British Army and the military police. You know, he had lots of funny stories. He went to industrial school as a kid, and he hated the Christian Brothers. He never spoke about that either. But they inculcated a deep hatred in him of religion, Catholic Church in particular, but all religions. He never said a bad word about Germans or Italians or French men that he fought against. He just felt they were all caught in this awful situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to say, if I'd been in a German uniform, I'd have had to do whatever they did. So he was very philosophical about it.
On the day, I don't know whether you visited the German graveyards or in Normandy, between 4,000 and 9,000 German soldiers were killed. 4,500 at least Allied deaths, 11,500 aircraft, 156,000 troops deployed, 10,500 casualties, just unending. Dennis, were you praised for your bravery when you came back from the war?
No, it was just after being in Europe, I went out to the Far East, and if the Japanese hadn't surrendered when I was in the Far East, I was due to parachute on Singapore.
And
that
how
was my next job.
And when were you demobbed?
Oh, 1946, September 1946.
And what was the aftermath like?
The aftermath.
Yeah.
Well, I just had to start from scratch.
Yeah.
I had to go and get an apprenticeship, and start my job as at that time as an electrician. I was still an apprentice, learning my trade.
And Corporal Boardman, did you keep in touch with any of your comrades?
Oh, for a long time. I used to go to Birmingham every year for a long time to meet my pals at a reunion in Birmingham.
And Dennis, can I ask you, did any of your comrades die?
Oh, a lot of them, yeah. Oh, crikey, a lot of my best pals. I remember when I'd landed, I walked to a position where I knew I was going to head to go for defending the village, and I fell over a pal of mine who had forgot to hook his parachute up in the plane, and he still had his parachute on. He forgot to hook his static light onto the plane when he jumped, and when I saw him on the ground there, he still had his parachute on.
And what do you, I presume you just have to move on.
Oh, you just move on, yeah.
Well, did you get his dog tag or anything, no? Do you do anything?
No, I didn't get his dog tag.
Okay.
But
just for his family, you know.
Somebody else got the dog tag.
Okay.
The medics came round after and they collected the dog tags.
In Band of Brothers, Dennis, there's one scene where one of the soldiers basically has a panic attack. He cannot move from the trench. I don't know whether you saw that series or not.
Yeah, probably did, yeah.
He cannot move from it. He's so petrified, to use Berner's word. He's so terrified. But his commander comes back to him and says, "You have the only way I can get you out of that trench, one, you will be shot if you do not advance, but two, you've got to get it into your head now that you are dead. You are dead. And the only way you can stay alive is by moving forward. Your chances of staying alive are probably 50-50. But the only way you can move forward is get it into your head now you're dead. And every extra step is a bonus."
Oh, yeah.
How did you mentally cope with that prospect of being shot?
I just accepted the fact that, well, I'm here today and I'm gone tomorrow. And just accepted I'm here today and I'm going to be gone tomorrow. And tomorrow came and I was still there.
And the next day.
And the next day I was still there. That's
okay.
Correct.
Well, stay with us, Corporal Boardman, and thank you again for your service. Stay with us, Eileen. Eileen Slevin talking about her father back after this break.
We'll talk to you after Lifeline.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
It's June the 6th, 1944. Corporal Dennis Boardman, who we're talking to, landed last night in France near the village of Ronville near Pegasus Bridge, which I think will become famous over the next 75 years. He has already taken on a number of German advances, and he's now waiting on the land troops who arrived on the Normandy coast 6.5 hours ago at 6:30 this morning, suffering heavy casualties, not as big as we were told yesterday, predicted over the last few days, but have suffered heavy casualties. Corporal Dennis Boardman is with us. We also have Corporal Patrick Yates, or Patrick Yates as he's known, and he is in the Mediterranean, and he is telling us that he was known as a D-Day dodger. Unfortunately, even though he was in the British Army and he had no way of getting to D-Day, but that's what they were known as. And we also have relatives of Corporal Bernard Gregory, who this morning at 6:30, 17, 18 years of age, originally from Dublin, lived in Manchester, was conscripted into the British Army recently and was sent to France early this morning. He landed at 6:30 at Vers-sur-Mer, and as far as we know, within 8 or 9 hours around this time, he was advancing and he was receiving help from a French family, and that family, we are told, will keep in touch with Corporal Gregory for the next 50 and 60 years. Now let me go to Staff Sergeant Jim Kelleher. Mike Kelleher, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. Your uncle is Staff Sergeant Jim Kelleher.
Jim Kelleher was, he was drafted.
Okay.
And by the time he got out of the service, his rank was Staff Sergeant.
Okay. Now you are Jim Kelleher. Where are you now, Jim? Tell us, 75 years ago, where was your uncle?
My uncle landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day 75 years ago today with the 29th Infantry Division. Okay?
Yeah, keep going.
Now, everybody going into the military, I'm also a veteran, by the way, Joe, and everybody going into the military, the American, you start off as infantry. Jim's MOS, as we call it, that's the specialized unit he was in, was EOD, Explosives Ordnance Demolition. And they were told that when they landed there, they would have to remove all of the mines that were put and on the obstacles, right? So you can imagine, bad enough landing, now you're having to remove the booby traps that are around them. Jim landed, he got a shrapnel wound that day. He was not evacuated. It was a flesh wound. And as he said to me afterwards, everybody on the beach had a wound because between barbed wire and shrapnel, you couldn't avoid it. Now, I'll just continue on.
Mm-hmm.
Jim went on, and that winter, it was one of the worst winters on record. And both the Germans had to stop fighting, and the Americans and the Allies stopped too, and everybody went into winter quarters. Now, Jim always said to me, when life is starting to look too damn good for you, look out, because there's a pothole down the road.
Yep.
Jim and his unit got winter quarters. Think of this for a minute. Jim, by the way, is a Kerry man from Glenflesk, the same as myself.
Right.
Better known for it's Johnny Crowley and Seamus Minan from GA Terms. And they found winter quarters in a vineyard. Isn't that wonderful?
Right, yeah.
A supply of plenty wine,
yes.
Brandy, and the lot. Okay?
Yes.
Now, suddenly they were getting nice and happy, and one morning his commanding officer came up to him and said, Sergeant, saddle up, we're heading off. There's a problem. And Jim said, where? He said, I don't know, but the Germans broke through. We're going to a place called Bastogne.
Oh,
right?
Yes, of course, yeah. In Belgium, okay. Yeah.
So Jim and his unit headed off. They were now under the command of George Patton, okay?
Yep.
They get up to Bastogne. Now, one can imagine what the whole scenario there, it was hell. The end, by the time Bastogne was over and the Germans in retreat, The Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
Jim had got wounded again up there at that stage, but again, not evacuated because there was a lot more people in worse shape than him. But the irony of the whole thing was the 101st Airborne, you probably heard of them, Band of Brothers.
Course,
they were the one under General McAuliffe. That, you remember the man when he said nuts to the Germans when they asked him to surrender? Well, the 101st were short of EOD people as they proceeded, and part of Jim's unit was assigned to them as they now made their way into Germany. Okay?
Keep going.
Now, Jim was a very quiet man, didn't say much. But he always told me one thing, that as they went into Germany, they had rumors about concentration camps, but they were rumors. And the first concentration camp they came upon was a place called Buchenwald. Okay? Now, a mile before they came to it, Jim said, the smell was unbelievable.
My God.
And when they got into it, now Jim at this stage had the rank of staff sergeant, which in our terms is E6. And when they got inside, and you can imagine these troops that were battle hardened, but they weren't ready for what they were looking at, right? So Jim's commanding officer came up to him, and he was shaking, and he said to Jim, he said, Sergeant, he said, you're a tough Irishman, he said. Would you do something for me? Look in the ovens, and some of the people in the ovens are still alive.
Would you
and some of your men proceed to take them out, please? Now, you don't say no.
Yeah.
He did. And I'm actually half breaking down thinking of what it was like for a man like my Uncle Jim inside taking out people that were still half burnt and half dead out of there. And that's one of those memories, he said, he could never forget. He finished the war, by the way, with two Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a Silver Star. I have his medals, and I have his records. His wife, his late wife, Helen, gave them to me. And I'm very, very proud of my uncle.
But he was wounded, wasn't he, Mike?
Yes, he was, but there were flesh wounds.
Okay.
And now, there was an ironic twist of one little thing that came down. Jim, on his final days, by the way, I went back to New York and for his funeral, and I folded the flag at his grave. And his last couple of days he was there, he went into the Veterans Hospital, right? And he got talking to a young doctor in the hospital. And the young doctor was interested to know his history and to asking him about what it was like in the war. And Jim said, you know, he said, the wound I got on D-Day on Omaha Beach, I got a shrapnel in the arse. And I never wanted to tell that to anybody because obviously I was running away. And the young doctor was curious because he said, Jim said that every time he went to the toilet, he had agony, but he never told anybody. It was never sorted. But when he died, they did an autopsy on him, and they actually found shrapnel in his rear end.
Yeah.
How's that for you?
Yeah. I'm just looking. There's an incredible sequence of events going on the British media at the minute. It's a timeline of what was happening at 13:41, which is just before Liveline started. The Germans seize Colville-sur-Mer again, but German resistance at Dog Green, Easy Green, Easy Red and White Red stops. Just before that, the Air Forces had begun bombarding Cannes, which is just less than 50 minutes ago. Just after Liveline started, leaflets are being dropped over Cannes, warning citizens of an Allied air attack. There are many casualties. Again, the civilians. 2 o'clock. Now is the consolidation. The last German defenders leave their positions one after the other on Omaha Beach. Troops now face the task of installing a solid bridgehead, a good position taken from enemy land in Normandy. Probably one of the key events of this day 75 years ago. Just what, 7 minutes ago, the bell tower of the church of Vierville-sur-Mer, which is housing German artillery observers, is destroyed by the USS Harding, obviously firing from the sea. And we'll keep people updated as they go along. When did Sergeant Jim Kelleher pass, Mike?
Jim Kelleher died in April 1992. I went back and I went to his funeral, and like I said, I folded the flag at his grave. And he was just a very simple, humble man. He came back after the war. He worked. He was a motorman for the New York Transit Authority under well-known man Mike Quill. And just gone on with his life. And this is only when I read his after he died that I realised he never spoke about nothing. That's it.
Okay, let me go back to Eileen Slevin for a sec. Eileen, you spoke about your father's trauma, which he only starts talking about. Maybe he demonstrated it beforehand, but you didn't know. But he only started talking about after the 50th anniversary of his landing on D-Day. How did he manifest or indeed show his trauma?
He didn't show it, Joe, at all. He would just talk about it, and if you asked him a question, he'd answer it and then just say nothing. It was like he was suppressing it. You know, if you said to him, was it difficult or was it bad? And he'd say, it was bad. And that'd be it.
Yeah.
But I think listening to your last caller, Joe, I don't think any of us can fully comprehend what these men went through, what they saw, what they felt, what they had to do. Like, my dad was actually a minesweeper. Right. Now, at 18 years of age, being a minesweeper, and then that other gentleman saying where they went into the concentration camp, these were life-changing events for these people.
For these young men, barely out of childhood. Yeah.
Yes. They didn't, you know, have a youth, as we know today. And I think that's what happened to my dad. It isn't that he shut down, he just didn't talk about it. And he wasn't really one for getting attention and glory anyway. You know, he went back to Versimer with my husband, he went back with my brother, and it was just, we did what we had to do, and that was it.
Nicola Hampson is in Sligo. Nicola, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And who are we talking about?
We're talking about my grandfather.
And his name and rank was, do you
he
know?
He was, well, his name was Dave Milliken. I don't know what his rank was.
Okay. And what was his service in the Second World War?
He was in the army. And I don't know too much about it because he never spoke about it, but he would never have gone to any of the celebrations of the end of the war because they were still prisoners of war for a year afterwards. And
so where was he captured?
He was in Burma.
Ah.
And it was obviously horrendous what he saw.
Horrific.
And he never, ever spoke about it.
And where was he from originally, Nicola?
He was actually American, and he was moved to England when his father died.
Yeah.
And he lived with his mother, and then his mother died, and he ended up in an orphanage. So he had a tough time because he then was sent out to work on a farm, and him and his brother decided they were going to sign up for the army, and he was actually too young at the time. But they took him anyway, and then obviously he left the army, and when he went to get a pension, they wouldn't give him the pension because he had signed up when he was too young.
My God.
Yeah.
And he never attended commemorations.
No.
Why?
No, just, I think he just felt that they were maybe the forgotten few.
Yeah. Did he speak about it much? I see you say he died recently, but did he talk about it much?
No.
Never
ever spoke about it. We'd just get little bits of information, okay. But never. Like, I just wish he had, do you know, because it would have been a great thing for us to tell our own children,
yeah.
Do you know, of what had happened.
Well, let me ask Corporal Dennis Boardman. Dennis, did you talk about what happened to you 75 years ago?
Oh, I often have a yap about it. If somebody...
No, but did you talk about... Sorry, my question should be clearer, Dennis, sorry. Did you talk about it in the aftermath, in the immediate years afterwards?
Yeah, oh, I did do, yeah. Okay. Oh, I used to have a chat. Meet some old pals and have a drink and have a laugh.
Right, okay.
Who's
that that keeps prompting you in the background, Corporal Boardman?
Hey?
Who's that that keeps prompting you in the background?
Oh, that's my lovely wife.
Well, and she's a sergeant major. What's her name?
Oh, Alma.
Alma.
Well, and she's born and bred in Ireland.
Okay, great.
Family comes from Mill Street.
Okay, Alma, fantastic. Tell her we said hello. Does she want to come on the phone for a sec?
Alma! She's there. Oh, hi. Alma's a great... Oh, I've been very, very lucky since I left after the war. Very lucky, and I met Alma.
And where did you meet Alma, Dennis?
Oh, I met Alma at the Arbutus Hotel in Cork. Hey, I'll put her on.
Okay.
Put her on.
Hello?
Alma, how are you?
Not too bad, thanks.
He is an incredible man.
Yeah, he's great, absolutely great.
Where did you meet? I'm sure you're a fan. He said you're a fantastic woman as well, by the way. I don't know whether you heard that. Where did you meet, Alma?
We met in Cork, actually.
Okay, and what? I won't ask what age you were. What age was Dennis?
Well, you should know. I think you have a good idea, have you?
Well, he was 17 when he was in the army.
Yeah, he's in his early 90s now.
I know, but sorry, what age was he when he met his darling Alma?
Oh, I don't know, really.
Okay.
I don't want to go into all
okay.
that.
And did you know about his army service at that time?
Well, no, not really, no.
Okay.
No, he gradually told me.
He has an incredible memory.
Oh, he has a fantastic memory, yes. He is a great memory, especially things that happened quite a while ago, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's fantastic, really. He's great. He can do everything himself.
Absolutely.
He's no trouble to me at the moment. He really enjoys himself, yeah. He has his own little hobbies.
Okay, what are his hobbies?
Well, he loves reading.
Oh, great.
And he loves history and...
Wow.
You know, he has a house full of books.
And Alma, again, stop it.
He actually has written a book, but...
we'll talk to him about that in a second. And have you family? Did he...
Oh, yes, we have three children.
And any of them follow him into the service, into the army? Or?
No, they didn't really know. But at the moment, there are 10 of them out in over at the D-Day celebration.
Oh, is there 10 of who? Of your relations?
Well, there's our son,
fantastic.
Colin, and Jane, our daughter, and their families.
Oh, that is incredible, Alma.
So they wanted to go this year.
In memory of their father.
Exactly, yeah.
And has he told them where to go, Ronville and Pegasus?
Oh, yes, yeah, they know all about that because they've been there.
Isn't that magic?
He's taken them many years when they were younger, you know.
That's magic. What a tribute. a tribute. And Alma, have you been out?
Oh, I have, yeah.
Yeah, and...
Well, we've gone every year, practically.
Wow.
You know, we stopped. The last one we were there, it was the 70th.
So how many times have you been through the D-Day landing anniversary, do you reckon? Or even visited? 10, 20?
Oh, we've been there at least 20 years.
Wow. 20 times. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it was one of the highlights of the summer starting in June.
And just, I won't keep you long, but I was asking Dennis, because the other people we're talking to, unfortunately their relatives are deceased, but Dennis was there, and I was asking him about one of the comments that we had on the recording here, that I was petrified as I came off the beach, absolutely petrified. Does Dennis show any of that? Post-traumatic stress or...
No, okay. He doesn't know.
Because he talks about it a lot.
He does. He talks a lot about it, and he follows it up, and he follows all his mates.
Okay, say what is... Hold on to the phone line, Alma, okay. And I want to talk to Dennis again.
I'll put you back to Dennis.
Okay, Alma, thanks indeed. Thank you kindly. Okay, we'll take another break. 51551 Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Alma was mentioning Dennis's, her husband, Corporal Dennis Boardman, who was on D-Day, there on D-Day 75 years ago, and has been talking us through, and she said he's still a massive interest in history. One of the people you might not know was an incredible interest in D-Day is David Duffy of Duffy Circus fame. David, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Joe.
What's happening at this time on D-Day 75 years ago, David?
At this stage, the Allies have made a breakthrough. They've got off shore Juno. Omaha, of course, was probably the most hardest one. But even at this stage, there has been a breakthrough. The Americans have started to make their way up the draws off Omaha Beach. And now they're trying to, form a bridgehead a couple of miles inland for the next waves that come across. And obviously all the supplies and everything are all starting to come in now.
And where are they advancing? Is it just a blanket advance, or are they heading for particular spots like Bayou or Cannes?
The beaches stretch over 50 or 60 miles to the left of the British and Canadian sectors. The British coming off Sword. Their objective was to take Caen on the first day because Caen was very important. That was a choke point where the Allies had to take to break through. But that was an objective of D-Day for the British. But unfortunately, it took them 6 weeks before they took that. On the American sector, they had made inroads in off the beaches, but then they were caught in the bocage, which people that know about Normandy is all the little small Norman fields that are surrounded by trees, and there was a lot of difficult fighting because obviously on that side from Utah, the 4th Division of the American U.S. Division, they wanted to get to Cherbourg because obviously they needed a deep port to start bringing.
Of course, yeah.
But this is where the Mulberry Harbour came in. It was an ingenious idea of Winston Churchill that he actually floated a harbour in from Britain, and there was two of them. Then made one at Aramosh and one at Omaha. The one at Omaha was destroyed in the storm 3 weeks afterwards, but they landed an awful lot of stuff on at Aramosh on the Mulberry Harbour.
And David, your favourite, favourite's the wrong word, Easy Company, 101 Airborne Division, Band of Brothers, where are they now, 75 years ago?
They've met up with the 4th Division. They parachuted in, on the early hours of the 6th of June, along with obviously the 82nd and the 6th Airborne, the British 6th Airborne. But they've been misdropped all over the Continental Peninsula because of heavy flak, because of pilots speeding up rather than slowing down to let the paratroopers jump out. But at this stage, they have rallied. The fact that the paratroopers actually were dispersed in an awful lot of areas around Normandy Peninsula actually made it that the Germans thought there was actually more than what was actually there. But there, the Easy Company, the 101st Airborne, their jobs were, again, to take the causeways, the draws off Utah Beach, to secure bridges. Obviously then to secure St. Mary Glees, which was the 82nd yeah. job. But they've met up with the 4th Division. The 4th Division were dropped slightly wrong at the wrong place at Utah Beach, was actually a saving for them because it was a more lightly defended area. So they actually, the 4th Division have got off. They've linked up with the 101st and they're making inroads now into the Normandy coast.
Incredible. And David, over the next few days, when did they realise, when did the Allied forces realise, the Allied Expeditionary Force realise that we are making advances, that we can push forward? I know it came to a shuddering halt at various places, but when did they realise we've landed and we will not be retreating?
I think actually it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks. Because
it was that close, that intense.
I think so, yeah. Because obviously, you know, the main German forces were held near the port of Calais because that's where Hitler obviously thought the invasion was going to be, and the Allies done everything possible to keep them misinformed, to make sure that they kept the most of their panzer divisions in the Calais area. But I think it was very, you know, again, even a couple of weeks afterwards, Hitler was still of the opinion that it was only a diversionary ploy at Normandy. But they did get bogged down. I mean, you know, they landed 6th of June, and the actual Battle of Normandy didn't actually finish until the breakthrough at the Falaise Gap, which was in mid-August. They expected to take, as I say, Caen the first day. Caen wasn't taken until 6 weeks afterwards. So it was a precarious situation. And there was a lot of Germans obviously rushed into the area. Obviously, like some tanks actually did get as far as Sword Beach on the first day, but the Allies had obviously, they had extensive air support. The German Luftwaffe was virtually finished at that stage. So tanks or infantry on the German side couldn't really move that fast, couldn't move in daylight because they were like hampered all the time from the air. Okay. But they did dig in and fought very well. Again, the Bocage area was a notorious area for the attackers. It was much more easy to defend. And then it wasn't really until after numerous attempts by Montgomery to take Caen against the full might of the German units. And then eventually the Americans managed to break out in Operation Cobra. They broke out from the San Lo area, and that's where they started to surround the German forces in Normandy. It all came to a head at Falaise, which was like 6 weeks after, which we know.
Okay, but as you're saying, it was not evident in the first few days that this was going to be a success.
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, Rommel's idea was to stop them at the sea, don't let them at the sea. But I mean, they had, you know, a substantial British head. But I think it was in the balance, like for 3 or 4 weeks.
Stay there with us, David Duffy. Let me bring in, because Alma Boardman, when we were talking to her a few minutes ago, and indeed Dennis mentioned that some of their children are in France. Colin Boardman, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. Yeah, how are you?
Good, Colin. Where are you now?
Oh, we're in Ranville now, which would be the town that Dad would have landed in.
Oh, wow.
On the 6th of June, 1944. So we came over just for the anniversary.
My God.
And to celebrate the time. And they have a big kind of a festival here, basically, you know.
And so you, your dad's on the other line, but you're standing now fairly close to where your father was standing in a completely different world 75 years ago.
Absolutely.
And did you...
Absolutely, yeah.
And did you know what part of the village, or maybe it's a small village, your father parachuted into?
I did, because he showed me. I was over here. Okay. I brought my mother and father over here 5 years ago for the 70th.
Yeah.
And he brought us down and he showed us the field he landed in.
Yeah, wow.
So we could go and see that and everything, and it was very interesting, yeah.
And did he then tell you what way he advanced and what they did next? And because he's been telling us.
He did.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what he said to you, right? But, but I remember 5 years ago, he brought us down to the field. And he said, he landed up there and he ran down towards the wall. And there was a couple of them there. And he threw a couple of grenades over the wall, a big 8-foot wall.
Right.
And he threw a couple of grenades over the wall and then ran around the corner and saw a few Germans kind of lying dead.
Yeah.
And then he kind of realized that that was okay, because they wouldn't be sure who was behind the wall, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So then they went in behind the next area, and there was a paratrooper, a British paratrooper, in a tree hanging down after getting shot by the Germans. So they were happy then that they got rid of the Germans that shot their buddy, you know?
Okay, and he also told us that he came across a friend of his whose parachute didn't open, Colin.
He was dead,
unfortunately, on the ground as they were trying to advance. And Colin, are many in your group over there now?
Oh yeah, I'm here with my wife, Tara Murphy.
Yeah.
And it's actually, could I say one thing?
Of course.
It's Tara's birthday today.
Okay.
So happy birthday to Tara. And our three kids, and then my sister is here with her husband,
Jane,
and their three kids.
Shane, your mother, is that Shane, your mother mentioned
that's
earlier as well?
Shane, yeah.
I don't know what age your children are, but are they of an age, Colin, that they can talk to their granddad about what happened?
Yeah, I've twins, they're 7, Emma and Caitlin, and Lily is 4. And my sister's kids are Caleb, he's 11, and Poppy's 8. And Sadie is 5. So they're all close enough. But yeah, Emma and Caitlin talk to Dad now about the war, and they'd be interested. And
And I know all our fathers are different to us in real life, but do you, this entails you standing back, Colin, I suppose, do you, because all we're getting about your father's been talking for nearly 40 minutes, and he's one of the few people we've ever spoken to, and obviously, I know Dennis sounds extraordinarily healthy, thank God, but the numbers over the years from now on, and as Prince Charles, I think, said in Normandy this morning, the opportunity for us to speak to people who are actually there on D-Day diminishes by the day. So do you, when did you first realise Colin, when did you first realise the enormity of what your father was doing and the risk to life?
Oh, I don't know, I suppose maybe in my 20s, I'd say it would have been, you know.
Yeah.
But we always just come here when I was young, you know, well, every few years, we always go to France on holidays, and quite often we go to Normandy or stop off at Normandy and see it. But we still didn't realise the enormity of it, you know?
Yeah.
But it was maybe only when in my 20s and so, and I came back. This is my 3rd or 4th year here now, since I've been, you know, grown up. But it's very interesting over here, and it doesn't get any coverage in Ireland is the big problem, I suppose, you know?
Well, it's getting coverage now. One of the things, now your father didn't say this, Colin, but other tapes we played of relatives of people who contacted us with tapes, they talk about being petrified on D-Day, you know, soldiers landing, soldiers being absolutely petrified. I know you say it doesn't get enough coverage in Ireland, but have we any sense of that petrification, that fear that young men, 17, your dad was only 17, 18, young men would have had going into battle 75 years ago today?
I don't think so, but I don't know. But I mean, I know he used to tell me that before they jumped, in his own mind, this was the end. He was going to die down here, and that was the end of it, and he's done his bit, you know, so he's just delighted to move on with his life after, you know.
Okay. Dennis Boardman, you're listening to your son, Colin. You're now in Cork. Your son is standing where you were 75 years ago today, Dennis.
Very, very good.
Okay.
Hi, Dad, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm still here,
Good, good stuff.
ready for the next parachute jump.
Oh, very good, very good. There was two guys, actually. There was two veterans. We went to a big parachute jump yesterday in Centerville.
Yeah.
And there was two veterans jumped in a tandem jump with the Red Devils parachute team.
Very good. Very good.
And Dennis, do you see yourself going back to Ronville? I know it's your family that are representing you today out there, but do you see yourself going back? I know you've been there a lot.
Oh, I've been there a lot. I'd like to go again, yeah.
Would you? Okay.
Oh, I'd probably hope to go, maybe go next year.
Colin will take me next year.
Okay, is it that or is it...
I've still got two legs and I can walk about okay.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm not in a wheelchair yet.
Okay.
Yeah, very good.
Is he... Colin, he's an incredible sounding man.
I know. I
know he's your dad, and I'm sure you've been petrified of him on some occasions, yeah. And probably he's been petrified of you on some occasions. But yeah. It is a great gift to have a man like that in your family, in terms of his service and history and what
we're very proud. Yeah,
That's good. So kind regards, Colin, to all the Boardman family and friends out there. Safe travelling. If you would send us photographs of the village of Roundville, because such is the interest in Dennis that people are hoping to see where he landed 75. If you could maybe WhatsApp us some photographs, but it's up to yourself with whoever you want in them, or just of the location, and we'll put them up on our Twitter feed or on our Facebook page.
Oh yeah, Colin,
safe travelling, and well done for making the effort. I know you've done it many times, for making the effort to go out there on this historic day, Colin. And I somehow suspect that your father will be back there with you again on the next anniversary, please God.
Very good.
So Dennis Boardman and Colin Boardman, his son Dennis, now in Cork, 75 years ago, he's standing on the spot where his son Colin Boardman is now standing, in the village of Roundville in Mayhem, the gates of hell opening on D-Day 1944.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Peter Cavison, you know, from Cavison's of Monkstown in South Dublin, fishmongers, restaurateurs, but you also know him from Monkstown, but today he's not in Monkstown. Peter Cavison, where are you today and tell me why?
Good afternoon, Joe. I rarely speak about my father. Well, I don't think I've ever spoken about the Second World War and my father's travels. Mm-hmm. I'm in Bonneville, which is between Geneva and Chamonix, and I'm just at the Route de la Resistance.
Wow.
And this is where there's a lot of people lost their lives, so it's quite emotional.
And what was your father's service, Peter? When did he join and where did he land?
Sorry, Joe.
Take your time. Your father, he would have landed in the Mediterranean near Sicily.
He didn't tell us half the stories he told Tim Coogan, more stories than I did.
Yeah.
So he kept it all to themselves, really. But it was amazing, the travels. He went to Italy, all around the world, fighting, and he could speak fluent Italian. Went in Anzio, at the end of the Second World War, he was in a foxhole when the war was over. But he ran away to join the army, because he ran away the first time he joined the Irish army, and my grandmother bought him out.
Yeah.
And the second time he ran away, he was 15 years of age, and he ran away and he joined the British Army. He enlisted in Belfast, and he's a big fella, 6'3".
Good God. And Peter, did he flee to Belfast because he wanted to fight the Germans, or he wanted to join the
Army? To fight the Germans.
Wow. Isn't that incredible?
The tyranny of the Nazis. I'm very proud of it.
And he was only a teenager.
Sure, he was only a child. So, I mean, when you think about it, he was just... I mean, really, when you think about your children of 15 years of age going out to fight...
They're doing their junior cert today, 15-year-old.
And there's a picture on the wall in my mother's house of my late mother. He was driving down the mountain being chased by Germans, fearless. They had no fear. And his leg was sticking out the window of this truck.
Yeah.
And the other guys in the truck were, because we met one of them years ago, and they were saying about your father was fearless, no fear at all, going down mountains, driving around with a leg out the window, and a big smile on his face, a big red head. So it was amazing what he's done. But he used to speak to other people, not to his family, about what happened during the Second War. I met this guy one day called Dr. John McKeever. And he said to me, I met an owl out up in Docky one day, and I was talking for about 3 hours. He's so interesting. And I said, who was it? And I discovered after a while, he's a fishmonger from Glass Tool.
Yeah.
And then I discovered that it was your owl lad. And he said, he's the most interesting guy. He said, I was supposed to be home in 1 hour, and I stayed to your father, speaking to your father for 3 hours. So the old man was great. He was great at telling the stories, and he loved people. I suppose,
as you all do in the family.
He didn't want to. I suppose he wanted to forget what happened during the Second World War.
And the John I know he was a commando, but the John Caveson, your father, he obviously had many lucky escapes, did he?
Huge lucky escapes. I mean, he got onto this battleship seemingly to depart somewhere. They were going somewhere, and there's a whole troop of them was on, and the ship was called back ashore, and the next troop got on the ship mm-hmm. and went out to the middle of the harbour. Next one was torpedoed. And there was another escape, so he had the cat of nine lives. He was amazing what he did and how he got away with all the escapes. All he came back with after the Second World War seemed was a scratch in his face. So he got more than the fish business. He got more scratch in the fish business than ever during the Second World War.
And he did 7 years. 39 to 47, the heat of it, the unending battles.
Amazing. I mean, and then he came back to... He married my mother in Dublin, and then they lived in, he went and worked for Avery and Hardell, and he didn't like England, so he came back and he ended up being a fishmonger. He did 2 years College of Surgeons, and he didn't make the doctorate, so he went to be a fish doctor instead.
Okay.
But amazing stories with Tim Paff Coogan and those lads and Stephen Miley. Great, they have all the stories. We recorded them one day for 3 hours mother's house, and of course I made a boo-boo of it because I didn't have the recorder switched on, which is I regret to this day. I thought your last interview that you had with that man, Dennis. I would love to have my father back.
Yeah. And what age was your father when he passed, Peter?
87.
And when was that?
About 10 years. He never went to bed early. He was making a tomato sandwich at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I got a phone call from my mother to say that your father's not well.
Right.
And there he was, lying on the floor. He was still warm. So he didn't know what hit him, but thank God for that.
Yeah.
But he lived life to the full. He was in the Eagle House on the Saturday Mass on the Sunday, Fitzgerald's on a Friday. So he went around and talking to people. He loved to talk to people.
Yeah. What?
He only used to drink a pot of tea.
Yeah. What a man.
Everybody in the fish market knew him because he used to get up in the fish box and if there was no fish, he'd say, give me the man who can sing in the morning, any old fool can sing at night. And he had a phenomenal voice.
And I just, because he survived the bloodiest war in human history, was it that propelled his good humour, live for the day and live for people?
I would say that's correct,
yeah.
And help people on your way.
Okay, where are you now, Peter?
I'm in Bonneville. I'm just going up to this with my daughter Lorraine and Maura and my wife. I've just celebrated my birthday.
So
we're over here for the anniversary of the Second World War, the end of the Second World War.
Okay, well done.
We're going up to this monument behind the house. So we will toast all the lives lost and remember them.
And you'll raise a cup of tea to John Caveson.
We'll raise a cup of tea to John Caveson.
Okay, Peter.
Sorry for being a bit emotional.
No, why would you not be in memory of such a legend? Well done. And a man who not just lived through history, but like Dennis Boardman and all the other people we talked to, Bernard Gregory, actually made history. So, Peter, go safely on your journey with your family.
One piece of advice, survivors or their children, record of any of the relatives that are there because have the stories and the history, which is phenomenal.
And time, the clock is ticking.
And thank you, Joe, thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
There's no show like a Joe show, as they say.
Thanks, Peter. And there's no Caveson like the Peter Caveson, and we now know why, because of the great, late, great John Caveson, and indeed his wife.
See
thanks.
Glass too. By the way, I'll see you on Bloomsday, Joe. I believe you're coming to do the opening.
That's news to me, but Peter, that's a deal. Okay, safe travelling to you and your family, Peter.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks,
cheers,
indeed. Bye-bye.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Claire Monsell, good afternoon. It's your aunt, your grandaunt, Una Annie Evans. Where did she serve, Claire?
Hi, Joe. I don't know that she had a lot to do with the D-Day landings, but she was WAAS She was a leading aircraft woman, and she was in logistics. So okay. I don't know whether it would have been, she might have been involved in the planning. I don't know, but okay. her story is individual because at the end of the war, there were food parcels and aid taken over to Europe.
Okay.
And my great grandmother would have written in her diary that Una was in Belgium and Germany and places like that. And apparently she was poisoned on one of these trips.
Wow.
I don't know, by a food parcel or you know, delivering them or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And she died. She was brought back to the UK and she died in the UK in an RAF hospital in, I'm not sure where now.
Okay, and what age would Una Annie Evans have been when she died, Claire?
She was 28 when she died.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah, so she was really young, yeah.
And she served during the Second World War, obviously.
She served, yeah. She joined up in 43, September 43, and the last entry on her records, I have her records, are that she died in active service on the 22nd of April. 46.
Because people forget for a number, well, up into the early 50s in the UK, there was still food rationing, and incredible, for 5-6 years after the end of the Second World War, there was still dire straits in many, many countries, including food. And where is she buried, Claire? Do we know?
She's buried in Donegal. Yeah, she's buried in Donegal. Is it? We were reared our whole lives, you know, being shown her headstone, and because it's a military, you know, it's a WAAF one.
Yeah.
So it's an RAF headstone, and it was a bit different from the others, and we were always shown it and we were always told about her.
Incredible.
And
so she's buried in Donegal.
She's buried in Donegal.
Oh, yeah, in Cork,
Mary's
yeah.
Church.
Okay.
Yeah, in Cork, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
But there's, I have her records, her military records, and there's different codes and two-letter codes and things that I don't understand. And I don't know if anybody can help.
Okay, well, let's put out a call now. If anyone, and there's loads of people out there, I think you can, Tom Bork and P, I know for First World War. Can anyone read or decode service records from the Second World War? We'll put them in touch with you, Claire. Stay there, Claire. Claire Monson, Sandro Cofola. Sandro, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe? Great show today.
Who are we remembering?
Well, all the people that died during the war. My dad was captured. He was in Italy, and their family were in the resistance with the famous Charles Forte, and they were captured, and he was brought to Auschwitz.
Wow.
He was there for 6 weeks. The Jews were wrapped in the wire cage and saying that the Jews were the lucky ones. They were only going to die because the Italians were off to Dachau, Hitler's personal concentration camp. And he went there for 6-8 weeks, and that was a terrible... That was the gates of hell. You mentioned that earlier. There's a 100-metre-long walk through Dachau, and they threw stones at you and did terrible things on the way in. But Mussolini said to Hitler, you can't treat the Italian resistance the way you are. So he let them off, and they chained my dad to a machine in the Volkswagen factory to make bullets. But it was really interesting because he lived down the road. He worked down the road from Cabbleston's, and he knew John Cabbleston really well.
That's
but they
incredible.
Never talked about the war. I was often in Cabbleston's with my dad, and I never heard them once talk about
the war.
Isn't
that incredible?
Your last speaker was...
But hang on, Sandra, you say... it's true. Your father was a member of the Italian resistance. Obviously, Mussolini and Hitler were allies, so to speak. So Mussolini pleaded with Hitler, do not treat our citizens, even though they are members of resistance, as badly as you're treating everyone else. So he put them to work in a VW factory making bullets. But he's making bullets for the German army.
Yeah, and they said that to my dad every morning. They fed him bread and milk. He was chained to the machine, and they would say to him, the bullets are to kill your brothers and sisters, which they did. We have a long list of dead in the family from the war and resistance, including a very famous story of my auntie who dressed as a hooker, and she lured the Nazis into the woods, and the resistance had murdered them then, and there was two truckloads of Nazis, and we're not talking Germans now, these are people, we're talking Nazis, this is an ideology, so there's a big difference. Let's, you know, we're all in Europe now, we're not talking about Germans. Yes, it was Germany that started the war, but it was the Nazis, it was the ideology that, and my father instilled in that in me never to forget that.
Joe,
I know you're late. I'll tell you a funny story. My dad owned a fish and chip shop in Dunmary in beside the People's Park called Minos, and all after the pub would shut, there'd be a queue of drunken people coming in for the fish and chips.
Yeah.
And if Maggie Thatcher was on the radio, they'd all be cursing at her the way Irish people did.
Yeah.
My dad would say, you have no idea, those people liberated those in Italy.
Okay.
And you know,
good
this,
point.
So we have no idea what the other side
sees. And I say that just on the final Nazi point, Pope Francis today is talking about the Nazi barbarism of the Second World War. Okay. Okay, Sandra can follow all other callers. Dennis Boardman, thank you so much.
Okay, Joe, thanks very much.
We'll talk soon, and thank you for your service, Dennis.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, at ease. You can stand down now, Dennis.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
at ease.
I salute you across the airwaves. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Angus McAnally, producer. Ray Darcy's next.